Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. This time I'm introducing you to someone, well, I interviewed her late last March, and I've been holding on to this interview because, you know, we got along so well and had such a good time during this conversation. We decided, hey, you know what? Let's create a podcast of our own. And it took this long to finally launch The Beast Beneath the Bed. And so, you know, there will be a link in the episode show notes. It's about folk tales, fairy tales, and everything in between. And Tantri is the perfect co-host. She's absolutely wonderful. You will hear later in this episode the hilarious way that we met, which, you know, yeah, when I moved to Santa Fe, life was very grim for several months. I don't know if anybody knows, besides for my storage unit burning down and me getting whooping cough for 3 months, you'll have to hear how I met Tantri. So those first few months in Santa Fe were not pretty. But I got to meet Tantri, I made a whole lot of other friends, and we've stayed in touch even as she's moved to Seattle. I have to say that, you know, she's cynical, she's funny, she's pointed, she's intelligent, and yeah, she and I never run out of things to talk about. And I'm really proud of our venture about folktales and fairy tales, so be sure to check it out. It's another little aspect of my personality, I guess you could say. Her miracle, though, I was just gobsmacked because I could not even imagine anyone talking or sharing what she has shared. She's half Balinese, and so that kind of lends itself to her miracle or magical moment. And for me, it was sort of a mysterious moment, too, because when she told me the story, I thought, okay, I need to do more investigation and figure this out. So without further ado, let's get into my conversation with my dear friend, Tantri Ouija.
Two weeks late. I was supposed to be born Thanksgiving. I was born much later. I was born late. And I was born on the same day that my father's first set of puppets, Tantri Pancha Tantra puppets, which is a story cycle that nobody used to do. It's animal stories, was born, because there's a holy day of the puppets happens in Bali twice a year because this the 6 month calendar. And I was just weirdly born on that day. So the puppets that he has are my siblings.
All right, I am really excited to talk to you because you're such a good friend, and I rarely get to interview a dear friend on this show. And I've known you for what, like 10 years?
More than 10 years, yeah. I think, yeah.
11 years. And I want people to know you because you've just debuted your first book, which we'll get to in a little bit.
Yes.
But it's really sexy, and we rarely have sexy things on this podcast, and so I'm excited about bringing the sexy in. But
sexy and religious.
Sexy and religious. That's right. That's right. It hits both of those spots kind of, there. Yeah. Yes. So my first question is, you know, for every guest is describe yourself. Who are you? If you had to maybe go to a party or a conference and you had to say, this is who I am, how would you do that?
What I usually tell people is, oh, I'm a journalist and I write mostly about lifestyle, food and, you know, drinks and travel and things like that. And that I've done that for years and years and years. And I very rarely mention that I've written a novel because I find that most of the time, if you tell people that you've written a novel, especially if it's sort of sexy, they back away and don't want to talk to you anymore. So it's kind of like having written a screenplay. Nobody wants to hear about it.
Oh my God.
So I always lead with the journalism thing because at least that people, you know, they understand it.
Well, see, you live in Seattle now, yes. But you did live in Santa Fe, and that's where I met you originally. And you wrote here in Santa Fe as well.
Right. I used to cover the food page at the Santa Fe New Mexican. So I wrote like the weekly food feature. Okay. And then I moved to Seattle, and then I wrote a column for the Seattle Times about cocktails for about 3 years. And it was about cocktails and drinks, actually. It wasn't just cocktails, all kinds of drinks. I did tea and coffee and everything like that. And then they decided to sunset that column and switch me to a weekly column that's more like local travel. So I write about interesting places in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh my God.
Nothing too far from the center of Seattle.
I want your job. So basically, let me just start with the Santa Fe piece. So basically, when you were doing the food column here, you would go and taste the food, right?
No, I wasn't a food reviewer. I did that sometimes, but we had other food reviewers. I wrote features where I would mostly interview people about things.
Okay.
I would often try them, but I didn't try and like try food and then review it. Instead, I've interviewed the chef and we've talked about the menu.
Okay. Kind of well, okay. So let's move to Seattle because I love a good cocktail. Do you get to try the cocktails?
No. So I would write, it was again, they have plenty of food writers. They didn't need more food writers. So I write, like I'll talk about a specific alcohol and go to kind of a historical deep dive, which is kind of my thing anyway, is I love the history.
Okay.
Food. So, you know, the history of Negronis I did. Sometimes just interesting combinations of cocktails that people don't know exist, you know, cocktails with toes in them, just things like that.
Wait, like
the sour toe, the one in the Yukon where some guy's taxidermy toe or is in a bottle of alcohol and you drink it. It's a thing.
What?
Yeah. It's like a disgusting Yukon thing that people do, the sour toe, and you drink the cocktail with the toe.
Okay, is that the most disgusting cocktail you've heard of?
That or the snake wine with the snakes preserved in the alcohol. That's also pretty gross. And then, they're not all cocktails. They're also drinks. So I've also heard of beer fermented with vaginal yeast, which exists. And there is some kind of drink made with sperm, but I can't remember. Or semen. I can't remember what it is, though, if it's a beer or what. But it's
well,
a thing.
What will they think of next? It's like that coffee that goes through the body of a, what was it, a lemur?
Oh, yeah. A civet cat poop coffee. And there's also an elephant version called white gold or black ivory. Black ivory is what it's called, I think. Something like that. And it's coffee beans pooped out of an elephant.
Oh, okay.
And then cleaned and roasted.
I'm learning a lot right now. I just want you to know that.
The civet poop coffee is delicious.
You've had it?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's actually a Balinese thing that I think it was invented in Indonesia in the coffee plantations.
Wow.
And it's delicious because it removes all the acid out of the coffee. So you get this very mild chocolate-like drink.
Wow. And I guess right now would be a good time to say that part of your family comes from Bali, from Indonesia.
My father's side of the family is Balinese.
Okay. Do you get back there often?
Not often, but periodically.
Do you ever fantasize about moving there?
It's too hot for me.
Okay.
I live in the Pacific Northwest now, and I'm one of those people who loves the weather, which is unusual. I love the rain. I love the cold. I'm kind of an inside cat because I'm a writer. So I like any excuse that I have to just sit in my house with my laptop and my tea and not feel guilty for not enjoying life in the sun, which just gives me a rash and makes me grumpy and sleepy. I will take.
I mean, I feel the same way because when I lived in Portland for 23 years, people would come and then after 2 years have to leave because they couldn't handle the rain, the cold, the wet. And it can be oppressive. But if you're a writer or a creative, you have to stay inside. It's really cozy and you can get stuff done. You can bust your work out, whatever that looks like.
And I'm not going to ride around on the bicycle in the park. You know, I want to be inside writing about sexy Vikings or whatever. So the weather works for me very nicely. I also love very, very cold weather, which we don't get so much of.
Oh, that's true.
It's very invigorating. I like it.
So, and I have been watching you, you know, fondly because I like you, but also with excitement because you just have this column that I love that we've been talking about. And I love it when my friends are successful and are out there doing things that feel good for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this feels good for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I do a lot of, basically I can write about anything I want. And it's a lot of historic buildings, which I'm really into because I just love old shit. It's my favorite thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, old shit is my favorite thing. Okay. So anytime I can do a historic hotel or an old whatever or a park, it's got some interesting, I'm super happy.
Okay. Man, now I'm just getting even more jealous. I actually would be grateful if I didn't have to taste all the cocktails if they were in front of me because
it was not part of it. A lot of the cocktails actually in the photos, because I took all those photos when it was the cocktail column. I don't anymore. But with the cocktail column, I did. A lot of them are fake because like I didn't want to necessarily buy this alcohol. So you just mix it so it looks like the cocktail and it's just water, like vodkas or clear liquids. You just put water.
I feel betrayed.
Yeah. Like, I'm not going to buy a bottle of some, I don't know, weird vodka or something just to, so it, I don't drink very much, so I'm not going to.
Me either.
But okay. I do like mixing cocktails. It's a lot of fun. It's like alchemy.
It is like alchemy.
But I can only drink so much before I feel terrible. So I only drink so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question then, because I like to find these things out about my friends. So you did this column on cocktails. What do you think is the most innovative cocktail for its time in history?
Oh, I think maybe it's when they started swirling absinthe on the inside of a glass.
Oh.
Because that's pretty, I can't remember which cocktail it is, but that's pretty sort of weird and fancy for the 20s, but they were doing it then.
Yeah. Did that dose just on the inside of the glass cause you to see the...
Absinthe doesn't actually make you hallucinate.
It doesn't. Okay.
It's got wormwood in it, which in theory should. But actually, I mean, I've never had it happen. People say maybe they did. But I think it's just because it's very high proof alcohol and you get pretty drunk. And it used to make people go weird because absinthe used to be... A lot of the time it was cheap. So it was just cheap. Anise flavored cheap shitty liquor.
Okay.
And then you would, wood grain alcohol, whatever, you get very weird because it's bad alcohol.
Yeah.
But if you just drink absinthe from, nice absinthe now and you drink a lot of it, you're just going to get drunk. They say the wormwood will make you drunk in like a very awake way, which is why one of them, the brand is Lucid.
Oh.
So you're kind of like cannabis sativa where you'll be happy and awake.
Yeah.
Which I guess maybe happens. It's never happened to me, but that's the effect. But you don't really hallucinate.
Okay.
With absinthe.
Okay.
That's mythical.
I'm safe.
You can drink as much as you want. I don't like it because it's, I don't like Pernod or anything, but.
Okay. Well, I have a bunch of wormwood in the car, so I was going to, now that I know that it's safe, I'm just going to.
Well, I don't know if it's safe like that. There's not really enough of it in absinthe.
Well, I'd love to ask for your family, how did your Balinese, the Balinese side of your family, end up in the States?
They did not. My mother moved to Bali when she in the late 70s to study music. And then she met my dad and she started working at the State Department, U.S. State Department, because she's from L.A. So she met him there. They all still live there.
Yeah.
It's very unusual for Balinese people to leave Bali.
Okay. Because it's paradise.
Well, you lose the community and it's such, the families are so tight knit and everybody's so close that if you grow up in it, which I didn't so much, but if you grow up all wound up in it, it's practically impossible to leave.
Well, I was going to ask you, do you ever think about that? Think about that you would have wished that you'd have spent more time over there?
I do sometimes, but also I don't because I am who I am because of all of the weird disjointed ways that I, grew up. So
yeah. Okay.
You pay for having a lot of context with having a lot of, not chaos, but a lot of, dissociated, experiences, disparate experiences, which sometimes is uncomfortable, but then you end up with having a lot of context.
Yeah.
Which you have less of if you're more comfortable and you never have to step out.
That's true.
So it's one or the other.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. Sometimes I like living a safe life. And then other times I'm like, I gotta get out of this rut and jump off this cliff.
I think you develop a kind of sense of bigger context from feeling alienated a lot of the time.
Mm.
I think it's helpful in that. I mean, it's terrible, but it's all helpful.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Wow. That's a big thought. I love that big thought just came out of you. So... What? Well, I'd love to talk about, did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like for you and your family?
So yes and no, because on my father's side, when you're Balinese, you are Hindu Dharma. That's it. You are. 99.9% of Bali is Hindu Dharma.
Okay.
And Hindu Dharma is a syncretic form of Hinduism that combines Hinduism, Buddhism, and then the original Balinese kind of animism.
Ooh.
Which is pretty prevalent, I think, in Hindu Dharma. It's a lot of animism in it.
I love animism.
So it's its own religion, and everyone in that family practices. You just do it. It's built into your day.
Okay.
And my dad is a Balinese shadow puppeteer, so he's also considered a religious figure. So my dad is a religious figure.
What? What?
He's a Balinese shadow puppeteer.
Okay, what does that mean?
Shadow puppetry is like a theater form with flat sort of shadow puppets against a screen. And the practitioner is considered also a religious person because it's both entertaining and religious, the whole thing.
Oh my God, that's so beautiful. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, there's Chinese shadow puppetry, Javanese shadow puppetry. A lot of cultures, Asian cultures have shadow puppetry. And then Bali is one of the main, the shadow. It's a UNESCO World Heritage art form.
Wow. You know, I did have someone on the podcast once that talked about an evil puppet that was brought into their home.
Oh, yeah.
And bad things started happening all the time.
Some puppets. I mean, I grew up with puppets. Like, it's a whole thing with puppets. And I find some puppets to be quite freaky. Like, shadow puppets, not so much. They are flat.
Yeah.
3D puppets, a lot of the time, make me quite uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Especially ventriloquist dummies, which I don't like at all.
Ew.
I don't like them at all.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. So, was your mother ever drawn to that religion?
When you live there, you sort of practice it just as by default.
Oh.
So, it's not one of those religions where you have to... It sounds weird to say, but you don't really have to believe to practice.
Okay.
You don't know what's happening most of the time. You just go to temple. Everybody's talking. It's not very serious.
Okay.
And most of the religion is practiced in a language you don't understand anyway.
Oh.
It's high Balinese. It's called Kawi, and it's a Sanskrit-based religion, and people don't really speak it. So it's kind of like going to Catholic church and going to mass in Latin. It's like almost exactly like that. It feels a lot like that because it's a very in like pluralistic religion, kind of like Catholicism, which has a lot of saints. Bali has a lot of gods.
Yeah.
And a lot of the practices are even the same.
Oh. Because
when you have pluralistic religions with... I have a whole like thing about how Catholicism is in many ways actually a polytheistic religion masquerading as a... Is that okay to say? People can get
that? Oh, yeah. No, nobody's
polytheistic religion sort of masquerading as a monotheistic religion. And Hinduism is just a monotheistic a polytheistic religion that is considered monotheistic in the country of Indonesia for political correctness reasons.
Okay. That's actually fascinating about Catholicism because I hadn't thought of it before. But, you know, every day has a saint usually affiliated with it, and you can pray to the saint.
And this is exactly what the Romans used to do. The Romans had patron deities. And you would pray to the deity. And I don't know why that would be different from a saint, but it's because it's not.
Well, because someone said so, I guess.
Yeah, because someone said so. And it's very important to theoretically put a framework on it where you have daddy God. And then everything else you want to do is fine as long as you continue paying your tithes and whatever. So that's my view on why. And that's why I think, you know, the Protestant church rejected it because they were so uncomfortable with a pluralistic religion where you had local God. And local gods, a lot of whom are female.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually true. I'm a fan of the local god that like lives in a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just walk over to the tree and be like, hey, how's it going today? How's your Monday?
But there's so many like syncretic forms of Catholicism where you have different cults of Maria.
Yes.
And Mary, which are, how is that not? I mean, just because you put a fig leaf on it and say, well, it's technically Catholicism because God is God. And then, you know, this is it's like, yes, but who are you praying to?
Yeah. I love that. I love that they're, you know, I love the kind of the women, the nuns, especially Hildegard of Bingen, who was like a polymath, and, you know, Teresa of Avila, these women that had these mystical experiences in the Catholic Church that the Catholic Church endorses and uses as, you know, proof that God came through and showed up in the world.
No matter what happens, you can always put a framework on it that suits you.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, this great thing happens and it's because
yes.
of this thing we want you to believe. Isn't that great? So you can have this as long as you eat the pill with it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, I'm going to make the Catholics so mad.
Oh gosh.
But I mean, this book also is designed to make religious people mad because.
Well, I'd love to talk about the book because, I mean, specifically before we started talking, you said you invented some religions, not only for this series, but you also have another series you're working on and you've invented religions for them. And I find that utterly fascinating. How did you go about that?
Well, the one that's finished in Sea Succubus, which is my first novel of a series called Sea Succubus. The second book will have a different name. It's a modern contemporary urban fantasy romance detective fiction. I kind of go back and forth on the romance because it's not really structured like a romance novel. It's structured like a detective novel. So I changed the metadata. So it didn't, because it's not really a romance novel. I read a lot of romance novels, actually. And it doesn't, it's doesn't really read that way. It's structured like a detective novel. It feels like a detective novel.
Yeah.
And more, I think, guys like reading it than would typically read romance fiction.
Okay.
But it's very romantic.
Yes.
It is a romance. It was designed to be a romance novel and then just exploded into other ways. So
I can testify to me romantic. Thinking it's a romantic novel.
It's very romantic. That was the point of it. And it because it's contemporary romantic, contemporary urban fantasy, and it's about someone who's in a secret society. The secret society had to have a religion, sort of, that is like a very judgy form of monotheism.
It's those like, don't exist.
Yeah, it's a very Manichaean black and white science-based form of monotheism.
Okay.
Because if you exist in a world where vampires are real and werewolves are real, but you have to structure them in terms of being enemies of God, but you are only interested in the things that exist, that's kind of like scientific monotheism, where you have to find if you're going to deal with something, you know, because the secret society is very like sort of violent, like they deal with supernatural beings in a repressive or violent way,
yeah,
which in the book is sort of appropriate because they're also all awful.
Yeah.
So everyone is kind of awful. So you have to have a framework, like a mental framework for dealing with something that's supernatural, but also real.
Yeah.
And that kind of becomes just dealing with it as like a scientist or a cop would, where it's like, what is the evidence? How do we deal with it? Okay. We put it down and then the fig leaf and that's what God wanted us to do. So we've done it.
Yeah.
And this religion, interestingly, like there's a little joke sort of in there about how they view all things that are other than natural as evil. And natural in sort of their sense means that it dies. Because a lot of the time with things that are supernatural, a lot of the main thing about it is that they don't die, because a lot of supernatural things, I think, are fantasies about, you know, living forever. Everyone's afraid to die.
Yeah.
So vampires don't die. Werewolves do die, but they're stronger than normal humans, right? Yeah. And ghosts are undead people. So all of these things, technically, they don't die. So for them, anything that doesn't die is evil. So it's kind of a death cult in a way.
Okay. So, interesting.
But it's super monotheistic. So their view, it looks like the Catholic Church. It kind of looks like the Jewish faith a little bit. It looks a lot like the Masons.
Okay.
But they, like, for example, they don't believe in Jesus because Jesus came back from the dead. Therefore, he must have been bad and he must have been a zombie or something else. That's not okay.
Vampire.
Yeah. Or vampire.
Yes.
Something. Zombie Jesus. Came back.
Well, that's actually, I mean, because we were also talking about Tolkien and how Tolkien invented languages. And I mean, whole worlds, just like every writer creates all universes when they're writing. But a religion is, for me, just based on the study I've done, that is a huge, massive undertaking.
Well, and they kind of unfold because, you know, once you've got the kernel of the religion, kind of like building your own cult. All the other aspects of it just become logically connected to your logic. So if you've come up with some conceit for how the religion works, suddenly everything else sort of has to follow that conceit. So it's kind of not easy, but it falls together in a nice way.
You should have some sort of product that says build your own cult.
Yeah.
And then you have all these like pieces and people can pick and choose. I don't know. We probably don't need more cults in the world, but just a thought.
True. I mean, it would be like a good Instagram thing, cult starter kit. But you also have to be popular. So you can't like buy charisma is the thing. If you want to be a cult leader,
let's have our own Instagram cult starter.
Yes.
That would be amazing.
We could help
that would
people actually start be hilarious. Cults.
Yes. We could have our thoughts of the day.
God, how much could we charge for that?
A lot. We should.
But you really, you can't. Charisma is one of those things like, you can become more beautiful, but it's really hard to become more charismatic.
It's true.
If you're not born with it.
And actually, I discover, or like living through this world, that the people who are very charismatic, I'm not going to name names, usually are pure concentrated evil.
A lot of them are. A lot of them are terrible. But some of them are great. I mean, it goes both ways, right? Like most of your actors and your...
It's true.
Just anybody you like looking at is very charismatic. And
it's true.
A lot of the time, if you're charismatic, but you also suck, you're just a sucky charismatic person.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And also, you know what I've discovered, and I'm so naive, is that a lot of people, they want to follow someone else.
I think that they do. I think that thinking for a lot of people is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And then if they, the other thing that's sort of unsettling is that if they find that they followed the wrong person, a lot of the time they won't address it because people don't like to be wrong in that kind of profound way.
Okay.
So they'll dig in deeper. It's kind of codependent, actually.
Interesting.
Because you have to, in order to just not feel uncomfortable, you have to continue doing the thing that you now know you shouldn't be doing. So you have to even more believe in it.
Yeah.
Like how they got the Manson girls to kill everyone, you know?
Yeah, totally. I love how this podcast is full of sweetness and light right now.
I mean, I wrote a very dark book.
I know. But I want to ask you, when you were a kid, because when I think about you, I mean, I know many aspects of you, but I honestly think writer, and I'm not trying to diminish you or kind of pigeonhole you.
No, that's all I did when I was a kid.
Okay. Well, that's what I was going to ask. When you were a kid, did you think to yourself, I'm writing now, but in my future, I'm going to be a writer.
I wanted to be a filmmaker.
Ooh.
So sort of a visual thinker. And I made some films, but the thing I found about films that was exhausting is that one, they're expensive. Two, you have to have other people do them with you, which becomes a lot of, the amount of work that you do that's not creative work when you're making a film is so much if you're doing a lot of it by yourself that you just kind of stop doing creative things. So I started writing novels because it was the inverse. Novels are free. You can do anything you want. You're by yourself. You can do it anytime you want. You can do it in an airplane. You don't have to ask people for permission. You don't have to ask people for, you don't have to collaborate, which I'm not always good at. You don't have to take criticism you don't want to take, which I'm not always good at. And you don't have to, I mean, I wanted to do what I wanted to do. And it's one of the only ways to do that, that and painting. And I'm not a very good painter. So instead, I novelize everything and I kind of gave up filmmaking because I got tired of having to find toilets and catering.
Well, I mean, when you were doing filmmaking, I presume you wrote the script.
Yeah,
I wrote the very beginning. And then, and what was your longest film you ever made?
It was 90 minutes. It was a feature.
Okay.
But then
my God, that's a lot of work.
It was a lot of work. It took forever. And, you know, working with other people, begging them for their time, so it was zero budget and all of that. And I just wanted to sit down and just be creative. I mean, basically for me, writing books is kind of like how some people play video games. It's my hyper-focus for my sort of raging ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really hard to get that making films because so much of it was wrangling and compromising and fixing and time constraints. And it's just harder to, it wasn't as satisfying for me.
Do you think with where the tech is now versus when you were doing it, it would be easier these days?
You still have to feed people and get toilets.
That's true.
And you still have to deal with people getting mad at other people. And then you make the thing and people don't like it and they want you to change it. And then the person who paid for it is annoyed because it doesn't change. All that changes is in post. Sometimes it's easier to replace somebody's head. That's it. Nothing else got easier. That and I guess digital cameras are easier to load.
Okay.
But not one other thing is easier.
Okay. I want to ask you, do you remember how we met? Like the first day I ever saw you?
No, I never remember. This is funny. People ask me that all the time. How did we meet? I never remember how I meet people.
Well, this is a funny story for me. Okay. So I got hired at Iconic.
Yeah.
And it was like my first or second day. So I was so training. But right before I started, I got the worst stomach flu the night before that I've ever had in my entire life. Good. And I was throwing up. I was just so bad. But I didn't want to lose this job because I needed a job. So I came into work and I was standing at the register and I was like, oh my God. And every once in a while I'd run to the shrubbery outside and dry heave because I was so sick. And so finally someone was like, are you not feeling well? And I'm like, I really need to go lay in bed. And I ended up having to lay in bed for a week. I was so ill. And I remember they called Todd in because it was that transition time between owners. And so he came in to take over the register for me. And they said, don't leave yet. I don't know why they said this to me. They're like, don't leave yet. Go back in the speed lab and sit there and wait for a while. And so I was on the floor, like crouched over, trying not to throw up in the speed lab. And you walked in your dress looking beautiful. You were just like, hi, because I was like on the floor in this fetal position. And I was like, hi. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, I think that's a manager. And this is like my first day, second day, and I'm over here. I can't work and I'm in a fetal position. Oh my God. I was so, and then they let me go after like 45 minutes. I don't know why they didn't let me go, but I met you and I said, you're like, what are you doing down there? And I said, I'm so sick. And you said, yeah, that really sucks. And I think then you went to go do something because you got called to the front or something. So he couldn't really talk. But I remember being so intimidated by you because you just looked so fresh and like full of life and happiness and joy. And here I was on the floor.
You're more, I think, effervescent than me in general. But I didn't have stomach flu that day.
And I'm not throwing up everywhere. I just remember when I was over, you know, where they had the garbage and I was like in the shrub.
Oh my God.
And customers were walking in. And I was like, ooh. And I was like, why don't they tell me to go home?
I don't know. That's awful.
Anyway, that was how we met.
I don't remember that.
That's our meet cute.
Oh my God. I should have gotten you some seltzer water. What's wrong with me?
Anyway, yeah. I will never forget that because it's really hilarious. Really intriguing. So a filmmaker, because, you know, I write screenplays, but I never think about getting them. I don't want to bring them into the real world. I just want to get them down and out of me.
Yeah.
Someday maybe they'll get in the real world, but I've never done the whole process like you have. And it sounds nightmarish now.
It's just so much work. And it just, you know, the fun part where you're making stuff up is over so fast. And then the fun part, I guess, is making it look nice, but that's a very different muscle. And I just prefer the other way. I like to come up with complicated plots. I mean, this book is long because it's got a lot of plot in it.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite thing to do.
Okay.
So now I'm doing it. That's what I do.
Well, let me ask you. Now, do you really love fantasy, sci-fi, romance, detective?
Like, I do, yes.
So were your films in that kind of milieu?
A lot of them were, yeah. I think all of them were.
Okay.
So I always sort of throw in, it's kind of like M.R. James. It's like everything's normal and then I throw in like a fantasy thing sometimes. But sometimes, because, you know, when you're making a lower budget movie, making everything very fantastic is hard. It's much easier in a novel. So the newer novel, the one that's currently being finished, is a first book of a different series that's just fantasy.
Oh,
like straight fantasy. And I can do anything I want because it's just words and words are free.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, hard fantasy, dragons, romanticy.
Okay.
That one's more of a romance novel. It's solidly romanticy.
I love that word.
Me
romanticy.
Too.
Isn't it amazing? When I first read it, I thought, who came up with this? This is brilliant.
I don't know. It's such a good word.
And romanticy is having a field day these days.
People love it. Why wouldn't they? This is what everybody likes. It's fun. It's great.
Romantic fantasy and people falling in love.
I know.
It's like, will they, won't they?
I'm a terrible romantic. I never get tired of it. I remember once reading a romantic book. It was The Mists of Avalon, which is very romantic, but it's also very sad.
Yes.
And I remember throwing it across the room when I read it as a teenager. It was just like, no. It was so sad I couldn't take it.
I need to reread it.
Oh, God, so sad. And it's beautiful and it's so well written, but God, it's so sad. And I can't stand the sadness.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have so much trouble with sad romances. Now that I'm an adult and sometimes I think it's okay. Well, it's still poignant and great. Like, especially if it's a movie or something.
Like Old Yeller.
Ooh. Sad endings I'm not great with.
And animals. Don't
but I also love horror movies. And horror movies are always sad endings, but it's different.
Yeah. I hate horror movies.
Oh, I love them.
Ugh. You know what's really fascinating to me is that I've known you for so long and, you know, I'll talk about you with our mutual friend who I won't name. And he laughs because he loves how cynical and like biting you are because you just observe humanity in this world with such a quick wit and with no rose colored glasses. You're very astute in that way. But you have this romantic heart.
No, I'm the worst. I'm such a romantic.
Those two parts of yourself are very interesting.
I love reading just Regency romances where just everything is fine. It's my favorite thing. I love them.
Wow.
I know.
I had no idea.
I don't want to be cynical. It's just I'm presented with a world that's so terrible. It's just so much stupid.
It's true.
That's why I write fiction.
Well, I do want to tell you that I love your heroine
this
book. And she's kind of a mystery. And I like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, while I'm reading the book, you know, I'm like, who do I root for in this book? Because there are some very interesting characters. And they're not all bad and they're not all good.
Yeah, I dislike when characters are all bad or all good. I find it very boring. Villains should not be. I mean, if you're not sympathizing with your villains and kind of waiting for your heroes to stop stepping on their own feet or being a shit, and you're just hoping they're not going to be a shit, there's no tension left, because you know what's going to happen, because the good person's always going to be good and the bad person's always going to be bad. And a lot of times, especially with female characters, I feel like a lot in books too, but a lot in movies, they're always so goddamn virtuous.
Yeah.
And they give them these little pretend flaws, like she just has trouble being loved, which is not a flaw. Or she's just too smart for people. Or she's just, her hair is just kind of wild. It's just hard to take. It's like, these are not real flaws.
Yeah.
Right? Real flaws are being like a compulsive liar, or being just anything where that's actually causes you problems.
Yeah.
Because your behavior upsets others because it's not great. That's a flaw that you can work with. But I can't imagine writing a hero who's just so perfect, like in every way perfect. What do you do with them except throw things at them and have them duck?
Yeah, I think of Natalie Portman in Garden State.
I've never seen Garden State.
Oh my gosh, her character is so, what's that phrase that came up?
Mary Sue.
No, it was the phrase where it's, the character in the movie is a young woman
who's Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Yes, Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Yeah, she was a Manic Pixie Dream Girl. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
There are a lot of, I mean, Manic Pixie Dream Girls are, I guess it's sort of fun. Doesn't bother me as much. But Mary Sue's bother me enormously. Do you know what Mary Sue is?
No.
Mary Sue, or a Marty Sue, is a character in fiction that has no flaws and is perfect and is designed to be that way. And you know it because you just get bored. You're like, I know this person's going to do the right thing. Yeah, they did. And everyone always likes them and they're always lovely, but they're beautiful, but they don't know they're beautiful because that's bad. Mm. And they're also, and a lot of romantic fiction too, the women are also virginal and they, you know, they want sex, but they don't really know because it's not okay to be horny. And a big thing in this book is how shameful it is to be a woman who has a sex drive.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing to talk about when you get described that way. There's almost no way to describe it that isn't a little bit pejorative.
Yeah.
And because this book is about succubi, or I guess because succubus is Latin, succubi. There's that, you know, sort of shame, contagion aspect of it where you want, you know, especially in romance novels written by a lot of women, it bewilders me because it's like, they're sexy, but they have to be ravaged.
Yeah.
They're never the ravager.
Right.
And if you even think about it, it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
And in this book, she deals with how embarrassing that is.
Yeah. You know, I do have to say that one of the things I really respect and love about you, you just used the word pejorative, which I haven't heard in maybe a year or two. Nobody ever uses that word. And yesterday I met this elderly woman who's 80 who used the word bloviated in conversation.
Wow.
And so I thought, what is happening? I'm surrounded by these amazing women who are using these big words, and I love it because we just don't use big words enough. And I think big words are beautiful. And what I really appreciate about your writing and this book, and years ago, I read, I think, the beginning of this book because read a first chapter and there was something about Brownian motion. Do you remember that? It was taking place on a wharf or on a dock or something. It might have been a different book.
It was a different book. I don't remember.
You used the term Brownian motion and like these particles were.
I don't know what that was in.
Oh my God.
It wasn't this book.
Okay. I thought to myself, my God, you have me at Brownian motion because your what you write is so smart and encompasses lots of different fields because you're so smart.
Well, thank you. I like to write what I think of as like. Not elevated, I don't like the term. Bash for smart people.
Nice.
You know, because I mean, it's not high fic. This is not high literature, right? This is, this book was designed to keep you company on an airplane.
Yeah.
Like you want to read it. I'm not going to get a man Booker for this. You know, it's, you want to pick it up at the airport because you don't want to get bored on the plane.
Totally.
That's all I want out of this. That's like that's my target audience is people who are bored on airplanes.
Okay. Well, I don't fly, but I love your book anyway. So, Well, no, I hate airplanes.
I hate them too,
because they smell. A lot of the time they smell weird. You're also like crammed next to people that I don't like touching, people I don't know.
So do you drive everywhere?
I drive everywhere.
What about if you want to leave the country? Do you take a boat?
I take the Queen Mary, which is like such an experience.
Really?
You walk into the room. Yeah. Walk in the room, champagne bottle there for you, fluffy robe. They do breakfast in bed.
I didn't even know this was an option.
Breakfast in bed. And then the front has a massive library that has windows that look on the ocean, and they have thousands of books.
Kirsten, why don't you have a podcast about traveling without flying?
I should.
Brilliant. That's the weirdest fucking thing I've ever heard. Because really? Then you go, yeah, you go over to, the, I guess you go over to the other continent, and in theory, you can get almost everywhere in a car.
It's a true story, I know.
But nobody,
or a train.
Nobody does this.
Well, it's I like traveling slowly, you know.
I know, but that could be the name of your, you can delete all this.
Well,
that
I was just
be the
thinking,
name of your podcast, Traveling Slowly.
I was thinking you and I should do a movie podcast because we have a really good rapport.
Oh, yeah, we do. I'm really bad at starting things and then not finishing them.
Oh,
but
no.
You seem good at finishing
No,
things.
What I would do, what we would do is, you know,
I would just
we
be would happy do to the show up.
Yes. And then I would produce it. So
I
think about it.
Do that.
But like we could do so many things.
I also
like
had another podcast that I wanted to do. It was just about weird topics in like fairy tale and folklore.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Yes. Okay. Okay. So
that's
we should
religion
talk.
Adjacent. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good.
You can take all that out
because
though, I have a whole bunch of stuff that I was like, I'll never, if I start a podcast, it'll just be just like the blog. Mm-hmm. I'll start it. I'll do 10 posts. I'll never touch it again.
Well,
this is how I am with these sorts of things. If it doesn't finish, I can't do it.
I would do all the production so you wouldn't have to worry about it. You could just show up and be smart and we could laugh.
And I got all the content. I just
yeah.
can't do it. I can't.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, I would love, you know, the main part of this podcast or the main subject is for people to come on, the guests, and they share a story or stories. It can be more than one. About something, you know, maybe mysterious, magical, something that they've experienced that they thought was maybe even miraculous beyond the bounds of what we kind of as humans expect to actually happen in this reality. And I would love to hear whatever stories you'd like to share.
You know, I don't really have any stories because I feel like I have kind of a blockhead mentality where if here's my view on things is I don't want to say that like only things that are concrete exist, but I will also say that people who tell you that they know concretely about things that you cannot prove are making it up. So it's kind of like I think about how 100 years ago we didn't know that there were germs.
Yeah.
But they still affected our lives.
Yeah.
So now, in this moment, what is affecting our lives that we don't know about? Probably a lot of things, probably 99% of the things that affect us, we actually don't know about. Who knows? But you don't know about them. And if you don't know about something, don't pretend that you know about it.
Right.
Right. So this is kind of my, this is how I deal with like organized religion also, is it's like, it's not that I don't think there's a God. It's that there is no way to know what a God is. I mean, if you don't believe this, if you don't believe the lore, then there's really no way. So you're left with just observing phenomena and having like an open mind about what that phenomena is.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's kind of like being not religious and not spiritual, but just like having an understanding that we don't know anything at all. So pretending that you suddenly like know things. It's kind of like with science.
Yeah.
Science. By definition, not big science, which people have turned into a religion, which I think is bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Like science is always right. Well, science is not always right. So what is science? Science is specifically a method for using the tools you currently have at your disposal to measure phenomenon, to come up with an explanation for something that you're trying to figure out. And the tools always get better. And the questions always change and the phenomena are different. So all you can do with science is approximate that this is probably how it works. And that's not the end of the question ever. That's the whole point of science, is that's not the end of the question.
Yeah.
So when people try to conflate the two, it just makes me absolutely bananas. So I would say like I've never had like a spiritual mystical experience, but actually I don't know. Maybe I'm having them all the time.
That's
like, it's very possible that when I get weird woo-woo feelings or when I go somewhere and I just get weird vibes or I don't like it, I could explain it a million ways, but I don't know definitively what any of them are.
Okay.
And I feel like I'm very affected by invisible things, particularly like smells and pheromones.
Okay.
I have a really, really strong, like animals love me for some reason, which is not because I'm quite allergic to dogs and cats. I like them. I love cats particularly, but I'm quite allergic. So why they always pick me to sit on? Like always, it's been noted. Like they always come straight to me, and I'm like, this must be like a smell that I emanate, like a pheromone that I don't know I have, and I don't want them on my lap. I'm not like chasing these. Just like, please don't sit on me. Always want to sit on me. Dogs, cats, everything.
They probably can see your angelic halo or something.
Well, I mean, maybe I smell like sausage. I don't know, but things like that, where I just like, what is affecting me that I have no notion of, and it could be a lot of things.
Yeah.
The germs of something like germs that we don't know is there.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, I think about quantum physics and how, you know, they have no idea. They think they have a little bit of an idea, but even.
But they're just making it up based on math. And then the math changes. And it's like, it's interesting. And you know something about something, but knowing something about something doesn't mean that you have the answer to everything. And I think people are so desperate to feel like they have people, because now people don't have, increasingly people don't have religions. And they're so uncomfortable with the notion that there is no system, or that there's so many unanswered questions that they look for a system that offers them a feeling of complete structure, which is what big S science as religion does, which is like, well, science knows. It's like, science is not a person. Science is a practice.
Yeah.
And so that's not a replacement for a religion. And when you try to make it a replacement for religion, suddenly a study that somebody does that is in, you know, invalidated 10 years later or whatever becomes literally gospel to people, and they live their lives by it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, well, you pretty much know, for example, that you should get an MMR vaccine.
Yeah.
Right. You pretty much know that, but you don't absolutely know that. And maybe life is about making the calculated choice to get the vaccine, because generally speaking, you don't want to get rubella.
Yeah.
And yeah, maybe, you know, so maybe it does something else to you that is invisible, but you know you're not going to get rubella.
Yeah.
So you can only work with what you can work with.
Right. Right, right. We were talking, you know, about animism earlier.
Yeah.
And the Balinese people and the syncretic worship that they have over there. And to my mind, a lot of animists, or when you bring animism in to a religion or a way of worshiping, what follows with that naturally is that the world is alive.
Yes. And in the book the Sea Succubus book, the supernatural subworld, the parallel world that I wrote in it is very animistic.
Okay.
So like there is an entity that lives in the garbage.
Okay. Oh, yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
And a lot of it's kind of like, people say it reminds them of Miyazaki, which is because Miyazaki does a lot of things that are Shinto, and those are animistic.
Yeah.
So really anything can be imbued with like vital energy.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like chi, right? Yeah. Chi is in everything.
And like how people say, you know, like the Velveteen Rabbit, where if you love something and you have it long enough, it becomes alive.
Yeah.
This is also why I'm uncomfortable with ventriloquist dummies.
And puppets.
And pups in general.
Yeah.
Flat puppets, okay. But a lot of them, because, you know, you're lending your, and this is how Balinese people feel about puppets, is that because the Dalang, the puppet master, is lending his voice, his personality, his soul to the puppet, they are technically alive.
Fascinating.
So they're considered to be alive. And sort of wooey thing, I guess. Was born 2 weeks late. Was supposed to be born Thanksgiving. Was born much later. I was born late. And I was born on the same day that my father's first set of puppets, Tantri Pancha Tantra puppets, which is a story cycle that nobody used to do. It's animal stories. Was born, because there's a holy day of the puppets, happens in Bali twice a year because this the 6 month calendar. And I was just weirdly born on that day. So the puppets that he has are my siblings. They're considered in a way to be spiritual siblings. And then I was named after them.
Oh my God. First of all, I think you should have a t-shirt that says flat puppets. Okay.
You could sell it. That's a good one.
People will be like,
only flat puppets.
Yes.
No, flat puppets. Okay. Is better.
But how fascinating that you have these spiritual siblings. And I guess I don't really fully appreciate, because I don't know, I'm just learning about this now, just the religious fervor or religious adoration with the puppeteering and how those puppets come alive and exist in the world as actual beings during these shows. That's very powerful.
Yeah, you're lending your, I mean, this happens with ventriloquists too. You're lending your, whatever, your chi, your essence to this object. And I mean, so I'm in a tangent here, but like social insects. When you think about ants or bees or termites, it might not make sense to think about an individual ant as an individual. Because maybe, like, it's like one ant, you squish the ant, you killed the ant. But you didn't kill the ant, because you could think about social insects as actually one giant organism that is not bound by connective tissue.
Yeah.
So you could think about, like, where do we start with this?
Well,
with the puppets. Oh, yeah. So if you have a puppet, you've essentially got a physical object not bound to you by connective tissue and that technically has no living parts, but that you are using in a sort of, it becomes like being a cyborg. You know, if you've got a hand, like a fake hand, like a robot hand, that's a cyborg thing, having parts of you that are not organic, that you use as organic. It's not different from puppeteering.
Okay.
Puppeteering to me is like a form of cyborg, because you're using this physical object as part of your body.
Right.
And doing things with it that all of your body does, but with a wooden or leather or whatever object. So in some sense, it is part of your body, is kind of alive.
Yeah. That is actually really fascinating. I'm so intrigued. How did your father get into doing this?
It's family. Profession. It's a clan.
Okay, so for generations, or like generations. Hundreds of years?
Yeah,
or
I think so. I mean, there's actually she's a professor at BU, Boston University, called Britta Haymark, and she did a study on my family.
Wow.
That I think my mom has a copy of. It's very big, you know. But it's about the going back. I don't really know as much of it as I should. It was very thick. I didn't read it. But I know she did it, and she knows more about my family than I do. But it is passed down.
Okay. Did she specifically do the study because of the puppets?
I don't know why.
Okay.
She's an anthropologist. So.
That's actually really fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. You should probably read it.
It was very thick. It was academic. It's not, you know.
Yes, but I mean, it's kind of, that's such a beautiful and powerful thought to think of this vocation or this calling, if you want to use those words, being passed down or kept, you know, close, cherished
and
inside
taught,
your line.
It's taught orally. So, you know, it has to be that way. It's a lifetime. It's like a apprenticeship. You learn from the older Dalai.
Wow.
Because it's not really written down.
Okay. You've just blown my mind. I think that is so precious. Do you ever think about how precious that is?
I do. I mean, I don't do it, but I do think about that. One of my sisters was more, my half-sisters was more into it. Like I said, discomfort with puppets.
Okay. Yeah, no. I was curious. Who's the next generation that's taking it on?
Well, the nephews.
Okay. Got it. Oh, is it traditionally a masculine?
It's traditionally only men.
It's only men. Okay. What do the women do?
Not that.
Okay.
Well, it's not the most egalitarian society. I mean, well, I don't want to talk about that.
Like, well, maybe the puppets, maybe the women are like, thank God I don't have to touch those puppets.
Maybe. No, Bali don't want to do anything. You know?
God. Well, yes, it is a beautiful place, but maybe there are some things that are less than ideal. So.
Yeah, but it is beautiful.
Yes. There's a little bit of an outro after this, a little Easter egg where our conversation continues. So be sure not to miss that. To find out a little bit more about Tantri and the work she's doing in the world, as well as her book that she's just released, Romantasy, the Romantasy. I just love saying that word. The Romantasy title, Sea Succubus. Well, there will be a link for that too. She's absolutely fascinating. She's really fun. I'm going to provide a link to some of her articles in the newspaper. And yeah, she's just kind of your gal about town.
And that's also why I like her. She never bores me. She's always doing something interesting. And with that, I just want to say thank you all for listening and supporting the podcast. And please do check out The Beast Beneath the Bed. It is a labor of love. I'm trying to make it fun and spicy and all sorts of things. And irreverent, you know, because we all need a little more humor in our lives. So yeah, check out the link in the episode show notes. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Tantri. I mean, I don't know what to say with this because she's kind of this ephemeral, interesting, fabulous human being who is just here for the ride and is intelligent and cutting and all sorts of things. I mean, I've always thought of Tantri as this brilliant star that's moving through this universe. She's here to stand up for herself. She's here to make life better for others. She's here to remind us that beauty is all around us. And she does that through her interviews. Well, beauty and strange facts. I mean, I'm a sucker for strange facts. And Tantri writes these articles that are just full of strange facts. So, you know, we need more of that. At least the curious people in the audience need that. And I kind of hope and wish that all of my listeners are as curious as I am. So be like Tantri and be enthralled with the world. See where you need to learn something more, figure something out, what might intrigue you. Yeah, and then go for it. So don't let those naysayers say no. Don't let anybody stop you. This world is good and big and gorgeous, and it's just waiting for you to dip your toe in to figure all of that out.
But among polytheistic religions, you know, the fighting over the religion is not as bad because you're not fighting over an ideology. And a lot of with polytheistic religions, it's the concept is like the way the Vikings used to think about it. You worship the god in the area where you are because that's the god that has dominance over the area where you are.
That is beautiful.
So in this book, there's a lot of people doing that and they don't know, right? Because they don't. They practice their religion and they go somewhere else and they're like, well, who do I pray to here? Can my gods even hear me here?
Yeah.
And so it's the notion of like, how do gods work? They don't know. How do your gods work? They don't know. Who are the gods here? I don't know. So you go somewhere wild and you don't know who the local gods are. If you're a polytheist and that's how you think about it. I mean, what a terrifying thought. Of course, it would feel better to bring your very specific big daddy, everything God with you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because it feels like C.S. Lewis used to say about, what was it, muscular Christianity?
Oh my God.
It feels like armor.
Yeah, it does. It's a true story. I really, really love that idea, a God of place, God, goddess of place, or spirit of place. You know, they talk about it a lot in the Celtic areas, Scotland, Wales, God of place. So maybe there's an island, like the Isle of Skye might have its own god or goddess, or a river or a stream might have its god or goddess. And I think that's really gorgeous. You know, when they say absolute power corrupts absolutely, it's just like not good idea.
No. But I mean, also you have people who are alive who manage to do the same thing with money.
That's so a true story too.
How different is it really?
I haven't even noticed that. I don't know what you're talking about.
Money is kind of like magic, if you think about it. It's mostly imaginary. It's a token you exchange for something else that doesn't do anything, right? Like you give someone a coin and they give you food. That's magic, isn't it?
I think so.
I mean, if I were to give you magic beans and you were to put them in the ground and they were to turn into something, that would be magic. But the fact that I can demand food from you in exchange for a piece of paper that is a fiction is fascinating. So when I think about people with billions and billions of dollars, they're like wizards.
Yeah, I guess. Oh my God.
Sauron, dark wizards. Because what is money except power?
That's
to
true.
Do whatever you want? How is that different? It's imaginary power.
I love that. What a great note to end on.
We're being ruled by
a little
wizards.
Scary. Yes, we're being ruled by wizards. I kind of like it, but also don't like it.
I know.
And let's
it's
see.
Awful.
Those fates, their fates will to be determined.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens. Sometimes like something funny happens during the conversation, or sometimes they go off on a tangent or whatever. And as a bonus for the longer interviews, I sometimes put a little Easter egg in. Oh. So the Easter egg can be you telling where to get the book.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So go for it.
Okay. So the book is available on Amazon, like all books are, and you can go ahead and buy it there. You can also buy it at Iconic Coffee Roasters.
True.
Where they have hard copies. But getting, as an independent, you know, book publisher, like you publish your own book or whatever, getting people to carry it, bookstores, is very, very hard.
Yes.
And as much as, you know, we all hate the big corporations, we hate the Amazons, and we hate everybody.
Yeah.
Amazon has made it possible for people who publish books like this to sell them to people without a lot of faff. And it's amazing, because when Beatrix Potter self-published, she had to buy a printing press.
I know.
And I don't have to do that. And that is a goddamn miracle. So yeah. Not everything they do is great, obviously, but certain things are nice.
You know what I love? I love that you just use the word faff.
I love to use
and
the word
faff.
And
there you go. I haven't heard that in like a decade.
It's my favorite word. I watch a lot of BBC comedies and they use the word faff a lot. And it's
okay. Well, I like it. And also, I love that you brought Beatrix Potter in, because, you know, I'm rewriting the series. So.
I know. And your books are very inspired by Beatrix Potter.
It's a true story, but they're very dark and demented.
Yeah.
So I have to tell you a funny story. So my dear friend, I'm not going to leave her name out of it. She had the books, didn't read them. She bought all three.
Yours?
My books. Yes. And then gave them to her friend who had kids.
Oh.
And was like, here are these books for you, these kids' books. She got back to her and was like, what do you think you're doing? Do you have any idea what these are about? Did you even read them? And my friend was like, no, I thought they were kids' books. And I was like, oh my God, they're not. They're not. Okay. And the friend hasn't talked to her since and is like, I don't want to talk to you anymore. So my tagline is going to be ruin friendships. With this
That's
series.
So funny. God, it's all awful.
So clearly we need to start a t-shirt company. Flat puppets, okay. Yeah, ruin friendships. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, man.